Ken McLeod. From the day we launched unfetteredmind.org, it has operated without a paywall, advertising, or a subscription charge. This is only possible through the generosity of people like you. If you find our materials useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered Mind, A Trackless Path to, Part 12.
August 10th. A Trackless Path 2, evening session. I got it right, didn't I? Okay. What was your question, Roy? Microphone. He doesn't know what dangerous waters he's stepping into, but that doesn't matter.
I have a Talopa question.
Okay. Fire away.
Okay.
I don't guarantee to understand it. There's a lot of enigmatic stuff about Talopa. But
it's on page 22, verse 26. It seems kind of odd after 25 verses of let the cloudy waters of thinking settle and clear, let appearances come and go on their own. And in 26, he brings up a remedy, which just seems kind of out of place, because he's saying let go and rest.
Yeah. Okay. A couple of points here. What the Tibetan says here is those of less ability, you know, those of lower, you know, the lower class, spiritually speaking. You know, you have those of high ability, those of middle ability, and those of low ability. So this is, as you know, Wangpo Men in Tibetan. Okay. Now, one of the things, and we'll hit this directly in the wisdom experience of ever-present good. The way things were talked about, or the way things are talked about a lot in Buddhism, is talking about different classes of people, saving all sentient beings, all kinds of things like this. And these, in my opinion, and there are lots of people who will just jump at the chance to take me to task on this, are all mythic forms of expression. That is, they're expressing things indirectly, symbolically, poetically, etc. So, and I have this, you know, troublesome little egalitarian, I'm not quite sure, but I just really don't like talking about, you know, oh, you poor people down here, you foolish things, and so forth. It doesn't make sense to me, given what they're talking about. So, if you look at one's own experience, sometimes your mind is really clear and really workable, and you know, you just sit and you let go, and you can rest in the present, and you know, stuff arises, and you can actually do all this stuff. Other times you can't, right? And this, to me, is how Talopa is describing, what do you do when, you know, stuff is mucking around in you and you can't get anything going in your practice? Well, then you do some work. When your mind is less acute and does not truly rest. And this is very important. If there is no resting in mind, there is no possibility of doing what he's talking about. And we have hundreds, thousands of people in the West who have zero ability to rest their mind, thinking they're doing Mahamudra and Dzogchen, when all they're doing is sitting and their just thoughts are wandering all over the place. Very good friend of mine, many, many years ago, he trained very, very deeply in the Theravadan tradition. He's a very, very bright guy. And he started studying Dzogchen and practicing Dzogchen. And we were having dinner one night, and he just looked at me and said, you know, you really need a lot of stability to do this stuff. And I said, I'm so glad to hear you say that. He understood, because of his Theravadan training, what it really required. And there are a lot of people who don't. So if your mind isn't clear and it's not resting, then you actually do need to do some work. And so work the essentials of energy. These are energy transformation techniques. And there are many, many. I mean, last year we discussed the primary practice, which is a fairly straightforward, relatively safe energy transformation practice, which builds up a body of energy which allows you to see through a lot of obscurations and distortions and bring the mind to some kind of rest. The whole principle of inclusive attention, which I talk about a lot, is also an implicit energy transformation practice. If you approach the four immeasurables the right way, they're energy transformation practice. Even taking sendings in a subtle way is an energy transformation practice. And it's necessary in order to raise, you also have in the Theravadan tradition the jhanas practices, which are very explicitly energy transformation practices. And there are a whole bunch. And then you have the very high-level stuff you get in the Tibetan tradition, Dzogchen, like the six yogas of Naropa and Anuyoga, etc., in which you're using the symbolic representation of mind as channels and energy and vital essences and so forth, to transform basic energies of the body so that they become available for attention. And there's a wide variety. Most of them, particularly the higher level stuff, are inherently dangerous, so they need to be practiced carefully. And you can really, really mess yourself up if you practice them correctly, and I can tell you all about that. And so with these different techniques, you actually bring out the vitality of awareness. And now you've got something to work with again in the practice. So, there's in the Dzogchen tradition, the 21 ways to take hold of mind. It's relatively easy to get a copy of that text. There's 21 different techniques, all of which are various energy transformation techniques, and they bring out awareness, and that's their function. So there are a lot of different techniques, and I mean, through the course of history, there have been hundreds and hundreds of these, and lots of them have been lost. When I was in the three-year retreat, came across this really strange text from Nyingma, which all remains is this fragment. And it's a meditation on the four immeasurables using vital essences. It's impossible to comprehend. Nobody knows what it is, but it's clear there's a whole energy transformation technique based on the four immeasurables. It's lost, you know. And I mean, heaven knows how much stuff has been lost. So it happens. But there are all of these techniques, and it's a way of, you know, when everything's mucked up, it's a way of working so that you can regenerate energy in the system so that you can be clear and sufficiently stable so you can actually do this other stuff. Now, as one's practice deepens, then and that transformation energy becomes part of the way, it becomes deeply assimilated, and this is where you get into the 10,000 hour stuff, etc., then practice has its own momentum, and you need to resort to these techniques less and less. But that comes from consistent practice over a long period of time. More than you wanted to know?
That's great. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for you? Speak now or forever hold your peace. All that stuff. Okay. Page 26. The first time I taught this, we took, 3 weeks? Not quite three. About two and a little bit, I remember. It was a three-week retreat, but we finished it before the end of the 3 weeks. Yeah. So I'm not going to go through it in quite that detail tonight. Ever-present good in Sanskrit is Samantabhadra. In Tibetan, Kundazongpo. The in Tibetan iconography, it's the Adi Buddha or Primordial Buddha, particularly in the Nyingma tradition. It's also the basis of Shambhala training. Basic goodness is basically Samantabhadra. And this goodness that is being referred to is not the goodness of goody two shoes. It's nothing so naive as that. Represents a very profound tenet of Buddhist practice, which actually is borne out by experience. But in all fairness, I think it is fair to call it a tenet. And that is, the nature of awareness is basically good. Is basically good. Now, there's actually a little bit of experimental evidence for this. A friend of mine is a professor, and he got his PhD in the study of positive emotions, which is a relatively recent field of psychology. And one of his colleagues, I think, had been exposed to some Nyingma training and decided to experiment with what was the effect of having people gaze at the sky, clear sky, for 30 minutes a day over, you know, a month's time or something like that. Set up a control group, etc. And found, interestingly enough, that the before and after altruism scores, the differences were off the charts. There's your experimental evidence. Kundazongpo is usually depicted as completely naked, the naked awareness. And naked awareness, natural awareness, however you want to think of it. And so fundamental to this perspective is that when you let things settle completely and there's that natural clarity and openness are present, it naturally takes expression as compassion. Now, one of the reasons I've been referring you more than a few times to emotions and whether devotion or faith or compassion, etc., and actually making those part of your practice. Now, even the practice of sitting, like holding those feelings in one's heart as one sits, is because, in my view, the definitive spiritual quality is compassion. It's not insight. And I arrived at this through two or three different routes, but the principal one was the question, what enables you to see beyond your own culture when you've never stepped outside your culture? And it was clear from, or it is clear from looking at things historically, that it's not insight. You've had people of extraordinary insight who get completely wrapped up in the politics of their days, and so forth. The quality that allows you to see beyond your culture is compassion, because with compassion you see suffering and the destructiveness of suffering wherever it is, even if it is regarded as the natural of order things by your own culture. In many cultures, women have a somewhat secondary place, and that's seen as the natural order of things. And there's plenty of literature in our culture going back a couple of hundred years for that perspective. People who were less fortunate, well, up until the 19th century, the notion that the aristocracy were somehow special people, when actually they just had better food. That's why they were bigger and smarter than the rest of the population, because the rest of the population had very, very low protein diets. So the suffering of the lower classes was just regarded as the natural order of things. And wasn't regarded as suffering, or as anything as an inequity or imbalance in the society itself. But compassion, prevents, disallows that interpretation of experience. And so you find through the ages, individuals and sometimes small groups, that tended to the sick, the needy, etc., because they saw the suffering and the destructiveness of suffering. So, the purpose of our practice here is, from my perspective, not to get the highest wisdom. The wisdom and understanding that comes through deep experience enable us to see things more clearly, and in seeing things more clearly, then we start hitting compassion. And from this perspective, emptiness is the means to compassion, which is a little bit of the reverse of how it's often expressed. And Kunda Dzongpo or Samanta Bhadra this ever-present good is a union of compassion and wisdom. So Jigme Lingpa starts off by paying homage. And he makes it clear he's going to talk about mind, And as we've already encountered with Tsulopa, there's the analogy of space. He's well aware of the limits of metaphors we discussed this morning or yesterday. I can't remember.
Yesterday.
Yeah. I lost track of time, sorry. Now, the next nine verses are run through what are known in the Nyingma tradition as the nine vehicles, the nine yanas. And again, Roby, this is reminiscent of your question a few moments ago about that verse in Tsulopa. Interpreted literally, these come across as criticisms of the eight yanas in favor of the great one, which is Dzogchen, or the great completion. This, I think, is a naive reading. And if you look at this from a mythic point of view, let's take the first one. Suppose the house of a poor man contains a wonderful treasure, and although he has it, he doesn't know it. He continues to be a poor man. In the same way, you are tangled in a net of unaware thinking and don't know what you have. How heartbreaking, you beings in samsara. Now, can any of you recognize yourselves here? No? We can use traditional formulations. We all have Buddha nature. Unless, of course, you're Joshu. That's another matter. But we don't know it. We don't even know what it is. There is this possibility of a totally different way of experiencing the world and our lives and ourselves. And we don't know it. So it's like this treasure in the house of a poor man. It's there, but he's still poor because he doesn't know it. So what's a different way of reading these next eight verses is Jigme Lingpa is pointing to ways of approaching spiritual practice that are present in every one of us. This is what we do. Let's take the next one. When you turn your back on the path of natural being, how many of you here have done that? Only one or two. Okay. Mistaken notions don't stop at all. Right? So, Emma, how many of you have tried the ascetic path in some way or other at some point in your life, you know? Like? Going to practice very purely, you know. How many of you have taken the idealistic, everything is mind path at some point in your life? You know? I'm going to eschew this base materialism. You know? Nobody, oh, come on. You've all done this at some point. You know, or how many of you have got totally into materialism? Ah, yeah. Thinking that was the answer to everything. Okay. So your ascetics latch onto a single principle. Now, Charles long ago took issue with my translation of order and chaos, and what do we end up with? Mind and matter? Yeah. So you can change that from such flawed philosophies as mind and matter. In other words, all of us, probably some of us still do, tend to try to slot all experience into one category and make that the way we relate to things. You know, it's all mind. Or, mind is an epiphenomenon of the neurochemistry of the brain. So it's all matter. You know, one or the other. It's idealism or of one sort or another. And such philosophies were rampant in India. But when we take a one-sided approach, then necessarily things get out of balance. So how confused you are by wrong ideas. Let's take the next one. Mind itself is originally pure like space. As long as you use conceptual knowing to look for it. Hands up, how many are, can relate to this line? Okay. Now we were a little more successful there. You get stuck like a bug caught in its own spit. Okay. Turning your back on what is, you are still ruled by wanting. Because you cannot get at the basic emotional drives intellectually or conceptually. The intellect or that level of functioning simply does not have enough power or energy to meet emotional drives with any effectiveness. Now, he says, you listeners, but what he's referring to are this tendency to take an intellectual approach to things. And the next one, yeah, microphone's up here.
I didn't make that leap to basic emotional drives.
Well,
from the preceding text.
That was me filling in blanks. Now, mind itself is originally pure like space. As long as you use conceptual knowing to look for it, you get caught like a bug in its own spit. Turning your back on what is, just you are still ruled by wanting. There's your basic emotional drive. Follow?
Thank you.
So the next verse. He's pointing out the problem in relying on the categorizing of experience. Now, of the 18 early schools of Buddhism, the only one that really survived were the Shavastivadins.
You mean the Sarvastivadins?
Thank you. Sarvastivadins. I was thinking of the Shtaviras, which became the Theravadins, you're right. And you know why they survived? Why they became, all the other ones, you know, we don't have very much from them, but we do have the Sarvastivadins. Yeah, they made lists. So, the moral of the story is, if you want to be immortal, make a list. And then you will be known through history. You know, because it caters to everybody's conceptual mind, and you'll be revered, and things are very wise, etc., because this is a very good list, etc., etc. And the whole idea of relating to experience directly will never enter the picture, because nobody actually wants to do that. So, and that's the cycle of teaching on ignorance, interdependence, and samsara. You follow this meticulously, inexclusively. You know, the categorization, we have the 75 dharmas of the Sarvastivadins broken up into the dharmas of the of samsara, and the dharmas of nirvana, and the dharmas of the path, etc., etc. And all, you know, I was going through old papers, and I came across this wonderful diagram that I made of all of this stuff, and I went, boy, that's so good. It just shows you how all of this stuff is linked together. Bookkeeping. What does Jigme Lingpa say instead? Your mind is the source of all experience, patterned or free. Patterned or free is my translation of samsara or nirvana. You awaken completely when you rest and do nothing at all. So much for the lists. Don't need them. You just have to rest. And then you experience things differently. The lists don't actually help you. I'm not a great fan of the Abhidharma. The problem is the lists and everything are very seductive. They give you the illusion of understanding something. So how charmed you must be with this artificial awakening. Because it's the idea of awakening that's studied meticulously rather than the actual experience. Yeah, it's somewhere around there.
But Ken, that has served some people.
Yes, you're quite right. It has. But that's not what Jigme Lingpa is about here. What he's saying, what he's doing here is pointing you to your tendency to categorize experience into these lists. And he's saying, this isn't going to help you.
I'm not trying to argue or disagree. I'm just trying to say it has helped someone.
Yeah. I mean, all of these things do. Wait till you get to the next one. Caught up in, I'm going to skip to the third line here. Caught up in logic and analysis, you sophists distort how things are because you believe in descriptions of the two truths. Now, how much literature has been developed on the two truths? Yeah. Two truths? What is apparently, what is ultimately true, usually translated as what is relative truth and absolute truth. And, you know, we've got lots of experts in the room, but I'm not going to ask them. This is the backbone of the Mahayana. You know, this description of experience in terms of the two truths. And the first thing, of course, is everybody holds them to be actual truth. And then there's the relationship between the two truths, and how do you reconcile them? And it just goes on and on and on. And there are different versions of them, and it just goes, huge amounts of literature on it. I mean, some of it's really good philosophy. But, and I remember Dajun Rinpoche, who's the top Sakya scholar of his generation, extraordinary man. When Lobsang was translating Moonbeams of Mahamudra, one of his main resources was Dajun Rinpoche, whose arrangements were made for him to live in on Long Island while this work was being done. Why? Because there are all kinds of references in the Conjurer, all kinds of scriptural references in Moonbeams of Mahamudra. And the person who was sponsoring the translation of this wanted them to be accurately tracked down in the Conjurer. And Dajun Rinpoche's knowledge was so vast and extensive, and the Conjurer is 108 volumes of text, that if he didn't know the verse exactly where it was, at least he knew where to look for it. And so he's able to track all of these references down without too much trouble. And there's a long tradition of debate. And I remember Dajun Rinpoche saying to me one day, you know, sometimes, you know, in these debating contests, you get these people, and they didn't understand anything about the Dharma, but they were really good at debate, and they could be really, really hard to defeat, because they were so tricky. But it was quite clear they didn't have any understanding of mind, of experience, etc., etc. They were completely conceptually rooted. And this is what Jigme Lingpa was talking about here. How many of you have have relied and perhaps continue to rely on trying to understand Mahamudra. You know, and if you just figure out what it means, philosophy, I know you've done this because you come in and say, I'm trying to understand this, Ken, in the interviews. Of course, you've been received appropriately when you do that. It's a very, very long path. I remember Kala Rinpoche, who used to be invited by the Dalai Lama to come and talk to the geishas in Dharamsala. And he was very, very appreciated because they would ask him these very abstruse philosophical questions. And even though Kala Rinpoche was very learned, by Tibetan standards, he wasn't a scholar at all. And he would answer these questions right out of his experience, because he spent years and years in mountain retreats. And the geishas would just listen to this and go, wow. And then he'd come back to Darjeeling and say, boy, that's a difficult path. trying to understand it intellectually. So we have this tendency. And one of the things that I've noticed in people, you've heard me talk a bit about willingness, know-how, and capacity. Well, in groups such as this, you hear, there's a tremendous amount of willingness. You know, you're working very hard at practice. You know, that creates the energy in that we are able to draw on in this retreat. The degree of learning here varies widely. Some of you are very, very well trained in various aspects of Buddhism, and others are coming in, you know, really out of your love and interest in practice and haven't done as much reading or study or formal study or anything like that. But you've learned how to practice, which is great. When somebody says something and we're unable, it doesn't make sense to us, our first impulse is to try to understand it. And in this arena, most of the time, the reason that something doesn't make sense to us or we can't connect to it isn't because of our lack of understanding. It's because of our lack of capacity. We don't have a sufficient level of attention or clarity or what have you. And basically, we tend not to notice that and think that if I can just think this through. And so we start to analyze and think and intellectualize it, et cetera, et cetera. And it just doesn't work. And people really strain themselves. Even pop blood vessels doing this. The appropriate thing is to do push-ups. Just get out there. And that's the meditation push-up. And really work at developing clarity and stability in attention. And this is, you don't have to understand anything to do this. This is like doing push-ups. It's not particularly interesting. That's right. That's the story. Okay. Please.
Can I understand that knowing and conceptual is not the root to this?
Yes.
I mean, you've told me many times. However, earlier in your presentation this evening, you told us that there were thousands of people out there who were thinking they were doing Mahamudra, and they were just basically, in my words, confused.
Yes, okay.
And so, to me there's kind of a gap that needs to be filled in here somewhere between the thousands, of which I'm probably one of them, and...
Well, you're here, so I don't think you are.
and the absence of any kind of conceptual... understanding being the route to where we'd like to develop. That's a question.
Well, it's not the absence, it's the reliance. Suzaki Roshi used to say, give me a person off the street. 2-3 years. I can do something with him. If he's read one philosophy book, 10-12 years. Okay?
Should I burn my books? Or put them away?
Trust your heart.
You mean about putting my books away?
That and a lot of other things too. And really, one of the aspects of practice we've talked a lot about is just resting, and resting really does require trusting your heart, and that's what makes it so challenging for many people. So that's what I say to you, trust your heart.
Thank you.
Okay. There was once a hard-working and generous farmer who had several idle and greedy sons. On his deathbed, he told them that they would find his treasure if they were to dig in a certain field. As soon as the old man was dead, the sons hurried to the fields, which they dug up from one end to another, and with increasing desperation and concentration when they did not find the gold in the place indicated. But they found no gold at all. Realizing that in his generosity their father must have given his gold away during his lifetime, they abandoned the search. Then it occurred to them, since the land had been prepared, they might as well now sow a crop. They planted wheat, which produced an abundant yield. They sold this crop and prospered that year. After the harvest was in, the sons thought again about the bare possibility that they might have missed the buried gold. So they again dug up their fields with the same result. After several years, they became accustomed to labor and to the cycle of the seasons, something which they had not understood before. Now they understood the reason for their father's method of training them, and they became honest and contented farmers. Ultimately, they found themselves possessed of sufficient wealth no longer to wonder about the hidden hoard. Building capacity. It's very difficult being a teacher. Okay. The next verse is about Kriya Tantra. Kriya Tantra is all about ritual. And how many of you at some point in your practice have been obsessed with being absolutely pure? Doing it exactly right. Okay. So pay attention here. Mind itself doesn't take up the good or give up the bad. Okay? We saw that in Tilopa's verse talking about spaces beyond color. A shrewd moral practice acts as an added pollutant. Because you're always thinking about, oh, is this right? Is it doing it? Oh, is this wrong? The forms of dualistic fixation distort what is not to. And so Ritual Tantra is how I translated Kriya Tantra. So I wanted to put this into English and without these strange Sanskrit words as much as possible. So, all of these practices serve a purpose for certain stages of spiritual development. But what Jigme Lenpa is pointing out is these tendencies in us. Is, okay, I'm going to be totally pure in my practice. I'm going to do it just right. And as I say in my commentary on the Heart Sutra, the desire for purity is an expression of anger and always leads to war. Pure morals, pure food, pardon? Pure vows, pure art. They're the ones who are engaged in pure art are the most aggressive artists. Pure ideology, they're the ones that kill. The ideologues who are obsessed with purity of ideology, they're the ones who kill others. So the desire for purity is an expression of anger because you can't stand dirt. Dirt. You don't want to have anything to do with dirt. Next is behavioral tantra. Yes. Microphone, please.
That's like rejecting a part of yourself.
Exactly.
And not accepting yourself.
Or parts of yourself. And we do this. People don't want to have anything to do with certain aspects of themselves. I mean, some people take ordination because they absolutely don't want to have anything to do with their sexuality. And they're almost always the ones to break their vows first. Because you cannot cut yourself off from this stuff. Yeah. And that's why Jigme Lenpa says, the forms of dualistic fixation distort what is not true. Now, behavioral tantra is it's Upaya tantra. And in this form of practice, you make every aspect of how you live part of your spiritual practice. So everything becomes, every action becomes endowed with a symbolic significance. So when you're sweeping the floor, you're sweeping away distortions and obscurations and things like that. So Jigme Lenpa says, the natural condition is not good or bad, it doesn't grow or fade. Even when you stop ordinary concepts with outlook, practice, and behavior, you still hold as real your activity and means and wisdom. And the problem here is you really think you're actually doing this. Now, how many of you have done this at some stage in your practice? Yeah. You take it all very literally. We do this. In behavioral tantra, you waste time doing stuff when there is nothing to do. How tiring your chosen disciplines. Please note, someone who said disciples when you're reading it notes disciplines. Behavioral philosophy. Then we come into union tantra or yoga tantra. This is where you actually begin to identify with the Iram or deity. And you see the deity as a symbol of awakened mind. And but you get caught up in the symbology and attached to it as having significance in and of itself. And at this level, you get into the outer, inner, secret, all these different levels of interpretation, which Tibetan Buddhism abounds in. I mean, it's really great stuff in one way, but you really get mired in it another and another. The next one, and I'm not sure why Jigme Lingpa does this, he skips from Yoga Tantra to Anu Yoga. The usual order is to go to Maha Yoga first, but for whatever reason, he skips here. This is where you're working with subtle energies of the body and energy transformation practices. So he's talking about using complex practices to relieve and refresh mind channels and energy. And what happens here is that you get caught up in this way of working, and you take these the channels and the energies to be actual real things. This is your physiology. The experiences that are generated are real experiences, when actually they're similitudes of awakening. They aren't actual awakening, they're similitudes. And the idea at this level of practice is you generate these similitudes so that you become very, very deeply familiar with it, and it increases the possibility of the mind just dropping in to awakening. And the contrast is what you find in the first two lines. By resting in a state that doesn't rely on effort or practice, you can use the result, pure being, as the path, which is a lot of what we've been talked about. You just rest naturally. But people get fixated on generating states of bliss, states of clarity, states of non-thought, etc. And so what he's talking about is that tendency is to become obsessed with the kinds of experiences that you can generate through energy transformation practices. And we find this, you know, how popular are books on sexual tantra? You know, I mean, what's the big contribution of Eastern spirituality to the West? Better sex. Yes.
I was just curious on all these practices, you know, how much of it is, like when we did the practice the other morning, manipulating your experience? You know, when you're doing these...
Which practice did we do
the other... Well, these like tantric practices, is that considered manipulating your experience to induce a bliss state?
Yeah, you're definitely drawing, working with basic energies in the body to produce bliss states. And that's the heart of the Kagyu tradition, is you generate these intense bliss states, and then you use the intensity of that bliss to power attention. Which allows very profound levels of insight to arise. And that's the purpose of generating those bliss states, is to power attention. Okay? And I know, discussing this with Trungpa Rinpoche once, and basically said, well, you know, you introduce people to Mahamudra, and if they get it, that's fine. And if they don't get it, then you give them this practice. And, you know, and it's just the ones who really don't get it that need this really powerful stuff. But people get obsessed with these higher level practices. I know many, many people who, and you see this very much in yoga circles, they really attach to the states of bliss that they're able to generate, and it becomes an obsession, and you can see it in people, because when people become obsessed with those kinds of things, you'll see that there's an imbalance which generates in the body, and there'll be lines of strain in their face and in their way their body is, because they're actually sapping energy of the body for this. Okay. Claudia?
I find these texts that say no effort, no practice frustrating. I mean, because you just said it maybe 5 minutes ago. How much effort, how much practice, how many years of working with attention and stability and developing a clear mind. Yes, once you have all that done, then you do a practice that requires no effort. But I don't think it's very clear in these texts, and I think that's why people get confused.
You're absolutely right. We are studying and working with high-level mystical texts. If you put it into Western vocabulary, very, very high-level stuff, in which, in most other contexts, or in earlier times, let's say, you would only be exposed to these texts after you had gone through a very, very rigorous training. But that's not the nature of the world that we live in today. And it's very little we can do about that. And there, as has already happened in other religious traditions, there are going to be many, many people who take the stuff and think they can do it and not make any effort, etc. And they will be hopelessly misled. We have a very famous example of this. It's Milarepa. After Milarepa had murdered most of his relatives through black magic, his sorcery teacher came back from a patron who had died. And his sorcery teacher said, you know, Milarepa, it wasn't called Milarepa at this point, Tupaca, I think is what it was called. We've done a lot of bad stuff. We've really done a lot of bad stuff. So we got to do something about this. So either you stay here and take care of my family and I'll go off and practice the Dharma, or you go off and practice the Dharma and I'll provide you with the means to do so, and I'll take care of my family and everything. And Milarepa is quite taken back by the this, because I mean, this teacher taught him and finally got revenge on being robbed of his inheritance by his uncle and other relatives. But it struck a chord in him, and so he said, "I'll go and work at this." And he went off and happened to come across a very famous Dzogchen teacher, very highly regarded Dzogchen teacher. And the teacher said to him, "Ah, yes, I have a teaching, and it's a famous teaching in the Dzogchen tradition. You meditate in the day, and you awaken to Buddhahood in the day, and you meditate in the evening, you awaken to Buddhahood in the evening." Sounds wonderful, doesn't it? And he gave this to Milarepa, and Milarepa took it literally, and just sat in his cave, didn't do anything. And a week, two later, teacher came out to check on him, and saw that nothing had happened. He went, "I may have been a little too lavish in my praise of these teachings. I see that this isn't going to work between the two of us. I think you better go and see Marpa." And so off Milarepa goes to Marpa, and Marpa takes one look at Milarepa, hears the story, and says, knows what he has to do, and puts him to work. So you're absolutely right.
I would like to piggyback on that question with maybe too practical a question about practice. So should I wait or ask?
No, go ahead.
Okay, so I'm reading Clarifying the Natural State.
Yeah.
And there's, it's very 1 foot in front of the other. First you do this, then you do that.
Yeah.
First you start with a stick. You start with a stick in the daylight. Then you put the stick, you know, in the shadow and all of that. My own experience is that I always end up circling back. For example, with developing stability, you develop to a certain point and then bring in some energy, and then you have to go back to stability. And then you do the insight, which gives you a blast of energy, and you have to go back to the stability. So it's always circling back, whereas the book seems very linear. And in particular, one of the things that I noticed is, am I saying something?
She's on your side.
Oh. In particular, one of the things that's been the most fruitful for me has been kind of dropping into some kind of awareness just during the day and doing it over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And so that combined with actually just meditating for me seems good, and then I can combine all of the stuff. So it's very circular to me.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, should I just be sitting trying to get really stable?
No. No, you're doing exactly the right thing. These practice manuals say you do this, then you do this, then you do this. They leave out, they don't make any reference to how this is actually assimilated. It's like they're giving you the bullet points. And those who interpret books literally think, oh, bullet point one, bullet point two, and they say, oh, stage one, stage two, stage three, etc. But that's the literal interpretation. When you actually do it, it is exactly as you describe. There's a constant circling back. So you develop a bit of ability, then it needs to be assimilated before one can develop another level of ability. And working at that patiently, going round and round, that is the work by which you build capacity. It's not a smooth, linear, step-by-step thing. So the way you're working, I think, is great, and that's exactly the right way. Many, many people are confused by the linearity of the presentation. But usually, or in other circumstances, one wouldn't be reading that text by oneself. In fact, in the way that teaching originally took place, you wouldn't be reading the text at all. You go to the teacher and they give you an instruction. And then you'd work with that, and then you'd go back a week or 2 weeks later and talk to him about that, and in that week or 2 weeks you're going through exactly the kind of process you're describing. And then when you had gone through a lot of the stuff, then you might be given the text. And now you have it for summary in case you for your own reference, and also in case you teach others.
Okay, I'm gonna take my book and give it to Larry.
Okay. Last one here is the Mahayoga Tantra, which is equivalent to Anuttara Yoga Tantra in the New School. This is where you're identifying with various deities, multi-headed, multi-armed. And here you're getting stuck on the reality of of the experience which you generate being the deity. Kala Rinpoche was once asked, how does Vajrayana work? It could be quite terrible sometimes. And so he said, well, there was once a man who was very, very wealthy. And he went to his teacher and said, how do I give up my attachment to wealth? And the teacher said, convert your wealth into white stones. What? Yeah, just convert your wealth into white stones. Well, he had faith in this teacher, so he started to buy up white stones. And since he was a very wealthy man, it took him quite a few years and quite a lot of work to find sufficient sources of white stones in order to, you know, buy up, use all his wealth to buy white stones. And eventually he ended up with these mountains and mountains and mountains of white stones. And then he went back to his teacher and said, okay, I have all these white stones, now what? And his teacher said, who wants white stones? So, mind itself has no heads, hands, or regalia. When you fall into the mistake of seeing what arises as a deity's form or hold mistaken ideas about sound as a mantra, you won't see what is true. Who wants white stones? Okay, so we all have these tendencies in us, and this is what Jigme Lingpa is pointing to, is these tendencies to latch on to one or other aspect of practice and try and make that our reality, and thinking this is what one is meant to do. Now he goes into a description of Dzogchen, also say Mahamudra here. My nature is great completion. All experience, patterned and free, is complete. So let's go through this carefully. I'm going to put this in slightly different words. All you have is your experience, however it arises for you. So just take that in. Don't write it down. Just all you have, all you will ever have, is just what you experience, however it arises for you. What happens when you hear that? Anybody?
It feels freeing.
Okay, say a bit more, Larry. Feels freeing. Say a bit more.
Well, it's that line from Porgy and Bess. I got plenty of nothing, and nothing's funny for me.
Yeah. A friend and I went to see Porgy and Bess in L.A. last year, and I heard that song, and I went, wow. Anne, there's your song. Yeah, but that's what I meant. Yes. So all we have is our experience, however it arises for us. And something relaxes and lets go there. Okay. And then you find the next thing, nothing to discard or attain. Ah. Eric.
guess I just wanted to jump in before we moved on to the next step to say that I thought it was terrifying.
Well, yes, there is that too. And you're quite right. It's like, yeah. And it's awesome in the right usage of the word awesome. Yeah. Yeah. It's all of that. You know, I mean, there's no way out of this? Nope. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, this is it?
Ah!
Okay. So, this line involves a radical, potentially, change in our relationship with our experience. This is it. But Eric, you remember the other night, Joan was saying, well, you know, what if it takes a long time to work through a pattern? And you remember I said, well, okay, so nothing's going to change for the next 20 years. And Joan replied, well, still keep practicing, because that's all that makes sense. In other words, we have no choice but to relate to our experience. And a lot of suffering arises because we try to avoid relating to what arises in our experience.
I've never heard of that.
I see. Well, I'm glad to be able to say something new for your ears. The essential instructions are complete. What are the essential instructions? You're going to love this. Claudia's really going to love this. Let things take care of themselves. That's what we've been talking about, isn't it? Just let everything take care of itself. Now, there are countless ways that that instruction can be misconstrued. And I said the other night that when you take mythic or mystic ideas and interpret them literally, you get disaster. So the idea that, you know, oh, well, you know, we'll just build the city and let everything take care of itself. It's disaster. This is in working internally. And the other day, I made the suggestion that you replace the word I with part of me. So we end up with all of these different parts. And when you sit with all of those different parts, the miracle is, if you just let all of those parts do their thing, they do take care of themselves. It happens. And many of you described that, your experience of that to me in our conversations. So, please, microphone.
Could that also be viewed as the developing of trust? That
right,
if
yeah.
you have this point of view and then you do all the work, that things will take care of themselves after, what was that, 10,000 hours?
Well, it has a great deal to do with trust. I have a book, which I haven't drawn on yet, that I brought it with me, called The Joy of Full Surrender. And it's written in the 18th century, I think, by a Christian monk. And it's the description of the joy of full surrender to God. And it's exactly about this. Now, going back to the concerns that Claudia raised earlier, one has to develop a considerable capacity to be able to sit and let things take care of themselves. That's where the push-ups come in. That's where we all the work of practice. And what Charles was referring to earlier, that gathering the accumulations and clearing away the distortions and so forth, all of this stuff. It's building the capacity so we can sit and let things take care of themselves. And the one of the big pieces of capacity that we have to build is the ability to experience what's going to arise in that process of things taking care of themselves, because a lot of it's pretty tough stuff to experience. And we find this going right in the life of the Buddha. Buddha started off practicing with a couple of people who had very, very profound states of stillness. And Buddha worked with them and came to develop the same level of abilities and decided to move on. And he and a group of five other guys who all about the same level of ability, they were really very, very good at this stuff, sat down on the banks of the river in Arjuna and just said, okay, we're going to do this work and just eat one sesame seed and one grain of rice and one drop of water per day. After five or six, and think of the capacity that you have to be able to live that way. This is how good they were. After 5 or 6 years, of course, the bodies started to break down a little bit on that kind of diet. You lose a little bit of weight. And when I did Buddhist pilgrimage back in the 1970 or so in India, somewhere around Kushinagar or somewhere, I came across this sculpture, as obviously with Greek influence, of Buddha at this period of his life. And it's an astonishing sculpture. And you can find, I think we have a small picture of it up on Unfettered Mind's website in the Life of Buddha section, or a very similar one. But the sculpture is the skeleton with skin draped over it. And you just look at this and you go, because you can feel what it must have been like. And the sheer force of will to live this way and continuing practice when there's nothing left of you but skin and bones. There's no flesh on this. It's a skeleton with skin. And it's very, very, at least I found a very, very moving piece. And so Buddha, by this point, because the body's totally undernourished, Buddha saying, or Gautama as he was at that point, just saying, I can't think straight. And most of us would have been not thinking straight after 5 days. Buddha is after 5 years. Little difference in capacity, but there you have it. And so he takes nourishment. And recovers his health. And then he sits down under the Bodhi tree. And said, I'm just going to sit here. And he does exactly the practice that you are doing now. Exactly the practice you are doing now. He does nothing. And all his sexual desire comes up. Mythically, this is represented as the daughters of Mara. And he just experiences it. And then all his anger comes up. And this is represented as the attacks by the armies of Mara, the demon armies of Mara, who rain down all these weapons and things like that. This is aggression. This is anger. And he does nothing. And he just experiences that as a rain of flowers. And many of you have described having similar experiences where you've sat with intense feelings, either of desire or of anger or of jealousy or something like that. And you just realize, oh, this is an experience. This is exactly what Buddha was doing. And then the final one is pride, which is symbolized as Mara appearing before him and saying, what gives you the right to be here? And Buddha just touches the earth and says, I'm here. No defense, nothing. And he's free. It's the capacity to experience whatever arises. And that's why you do push-ups. The essential views are complete, neither order nor chaos, neither mind nor matter. In other words, the essential view is no view. Just take things as they are. That's a little hard to maintain, but that's the essential view. The paths of practice are complete, no effort to make. The teachings on behavior are complete, no do's or don'ts. What one does is a response to what arises. And the response is appropriate because there's no investment. So there are no do's or don'ts. This is radical situational ethics. Situational because it depends on the situation. Radical because it's not based on the sense of self. The essence of fruition is complete. No expectation. That's a little hard one, that one. Unless you get caught in this concept of complete, it's just a subtle reminder here. Complete, it's just a word. Forget about it. Because you have this idea, oh, complete, 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 and people attach to that. People will attach to anything. It's my favorite one is Nishu Kempo, who says, you know, some people say when you meditate, you should just let your thumbs touch. And other people say, you should hold your thumbs just far enough apart so a piece of paper can slip through them. And he said, people will argue over anything. So, now we talked a little bit about awakening mind, and the next verse is about that. It's all there in that one teaching. Awakening mind is the essence of all teaching. Awakening mind is the heart of all awakened ones. Awakening mind is the life of all beings. Awakening mind is neither apparently nor ultimately true. This is reference to the two truths. And he's just saying, it's not neither of those, so don't argue about it. Now we get into something which comes up in different guises again and again. It comes up in Longchenpa. It comes up in Rangjung Dorje in the Mahamudra prayer. To say anything, Eric, where's the mic, please?
On the verse on awakening mind, if he's not referring to the way it's traditionally taught, what is he referring to about when he describes awakening mind?
Remember what I did with Janet the other day? You don't?
I probably need to jog my memory.
Oh, okay. Your
now
turn.
I do.
Do you recall it clearly enough? On the one hand, there is this intention to free all beings from the vicissitudes of samsara. On the other hand, there's this knowing that there isn't a single sentient being. What happens when you hold those two together?
everything drops away.
That's awakening mind.
I guess I should say, got it.
So now when you read this verse, does it make more sense?
Sense might be stretching it.
Does it speak to you more, a little bit more?
Yes.
Okay, that dropping away, just there, which is right now, okay, it's the essence of all teaching. It's the heart of all the awakened ones. It's the life of all beings. It's present in all of us, even if we don't know it. And it's neither apparently nor ultimately true.
Thank you.
No, I mean, Jigme Lingpa's, preventing the philosophers from trying to make something out of it. You know? Okay, now. And it's good that you remind us of that experience, Eric, because just that experience to say it's not, it doesn't change it, it doesn't make it empty. And this goes back to what we were discussing this morning. You know, you can't make things empty. You can't make experience empty. Experience is empty. And to say it is doesn't make it solid. You know, there's nothing there to grasp. It's just there in the way it arises. And what we say about it doesn't change that. It's a realm beyond mind where experience is just there. No taking hold, no letting go. It is space free from all complications of thought and object. Because I am free from the thinking that distorts experience, the evolution of good and evil actions comes to a complete stop. What are deities, mantras, and absorptions meant to do? I'm not a wakefulness that comes from practice. Now, this is very much a Dzogchen form of expression in which it's emphasized again and again. This doesn't come into being, it doesn't come out of being. It is not something you make happen. And in the way that I've been talking about in this retreat, it's a way of experiencing things. It's a way of experiencing things. And it can be precipitated in various ways, just as I did right now. And when it's precipitated that way, creates the possibility that you can see ordinary experience, the ordinary way of experiencing things, in a different light. And it's very analogous to what I was talking about, silence and sound. That we ordinarily think of sound as the opposite of silence. And the point I was trying to make is that sound isn't the opposite of silence. Silence is what makes sound possible. And when sound arises, the silence doesn't go away. It isn't negated. It's still there. And in the same way, when this way of experiencing is opened up for us, it's not the opposite of ordinary experience. it's the way, it's the space in which ordinary experience arises. But what happens when ordinary experience arises, we forget about this way of experiencing. You follow? And first, we seek to become familiar with this way of experiencing, and then seek to be aware of that way of experiencing all the time in everything that we experience. So the two aren't opposed to each other. You follow? It's getting a little esoteric, but
I have a question about the portion that says the evolution of good and evil actions comes to a complete stop. Because what I'm wondering about is, you know, the understanding that there are consequences to every action. And so does this imply that by seeing things as they are, fully, then stops the consequences from unfolding? I mean, how would that work?
No. This is a very deep question. And you should study the Fox Abbott Cohen.
Okay. No, I know it.
Yeah. Because it's all about this. Have you had the experience of maybe you yourself or seeing someone do exactly what was appropriate in the situation?
Yeah.
Okay. What happens when that, when somebody does exactly what's needed in a situation?
It almost feels like time stops.
Right. How much residue is there?
It's amazing how clean it feels.
Yeah. That's, I think, what he's referring to here.
But it's not talking about the residue from old things.
No.
Okay. Okay. This helps. Thank you. Okay. Yeah.
And do those actions have effects? Yes, very definitely. But, as you say, they're clean.
Got it.
Okay. I like this next verse. Therefore, let go of the tangles of hope and fear. Okay, we're all cool about that one. We all know about letting go of hope and fear. I like the next one. Charles, you'll really like the next one. Let the knife edge of outlook drop away. What? That's my favorite tool. And then there are a few people here I know who will like the next one. Come out of deep meditation's cocoon. Get rid of stiff or pretentious behavior. Forget about expectations for big results. You know, you do all of that, what have you got?
Simple.
Yeah. Now, here we, next line, we're a little bit betrayed by language. There's this phrase in Tibetan, le de, which literally means to go beyond. And the term for nirvana, for instance, is to go beyond suffering. And it in English, probably in Tibetan too, but I know English better. It has this idea of transcendence, of getting way out there. And that's unfortunate, to my mind, because it leads people to try to reach for something out there. One could reverse it and talk about dropping, but then people want to get done something really deep, so it still has that problem of transcending in some way, whether going out or going in. I mean, one could experiment with translating, and I'll just try this out on you right now. In the state of attention that is neither meditating or non-meditating, what does that do for you? Yeah, okay. No, it's sort of like, where do I go now? but it removes that, you know, I'm going to take this big jump and go beyond. In the state of attention that is neither meditating or not meditating, evaluations of what you are doing or not doing disappear completely. Now, this is a really tough one. It's said that the comparing mind doesn't subside until the fifth level of... I think it's eighth or ninth level of bodhisattvahood. In the Theravadan... Pardon?
I think it's the eighth.
Eighth, yeah, it's up there. In the Arhat system, it's only the Arhat that's free of the comparing mind. The streamliner, once returner and no returner, still suffer from the comparing mind. It's really so very, very deep in us. The only way I know is to come back to the body. Because the comparing mind is always conceptual. And as soon as you find yourself evaluating your experience, come back and say, what am I experiencing in my body? And it'll stop. For a while. You know, 1-2 microseconds. Microphone, please.
And basically, several lines above there just dump that whole notion.
Yeah, but what I'm saying here, Larry, is it's not so easy.
It's not so easy
to just dump. What did you say? Maybe
I'm referring to the line, my nature is universal presence. How can seeing come from progressing through paths and levels?
Yes.
So, I mean, that's just dismissed. Why even talk about it?
Because whenever we dismiss it, it comes creeping in the back door. Usually before the front door's closed. You know, get out of here. What are you doing here? That's just my experience. Maybe I'm particular.
Right. You're right, but I thought we'd been through this before. As far as concepts and models and hierarchies and
Larry, I mean,
clearly we're just going to trash can this because my nature is universal presence.
Yeah, well,
period.
Yeah.
Let's get on with it.
Well, you just made my job a lot easier. Goodbye. I'm done. Okay. I'm going home now.
Okay.
that what you want me to do?
No, that isn't what I was talking about. I was, oh gosh.
Okay. Again, we have this awakening mind is beyond empty or not empty. Might have to rethink translating that. It's the original space where existence and non-existence drop away. This is all true, but you can see how easy it is to start attaching to concepts here. And, I mean, really read this as a way of experiencing. This is, there's zero ontology in this. There's no statements about this is how things are. This is all about how experience can arise. In awareness, indescribable, inconceivable, inexpressible, and here is very clearly a metaphor, the center pole is no corrective. Nothing that holds a position. And, you know, now we're right back in the area of groundlessness and everything like that. And it takes getting used to. And go back to what I read from Four Quartets. Go, 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 said the bird. Humankind cannot bear very too much reality. Implicit in this, you're not going to like this. Implicit in this is there is no meaning in anything. Pardon? Yeah, Claudia says, yeah, right, I don't like that. And what's being talked about is how to be in that. Now, it's very, very strange because when you don't hold any position, then if we jump traditions, you get into action through no action. Wu wei wu. That's right. Which is one of the very deep principles in Taoism. And this is where Taoism and Buddhism overlap. Taoism talks much more about how this actually manifests in life. That's why I make reference to Lao Tzu. Nature doesn't make long speeches. A whirlwind doesn't last all morning. A cloudburst doesn't last all day. Who makes the wind and rain? Heaven and earth do. If heaven and earth don't go on and on, certainly people don't need to. I mean, it's wonderfully practical. And it comes right out of holding no position. The vocabulary is different, but the understanding, what it's pointing to, is very similar. With simple, steady, self-releasing freshness in a space free from complications or effort, rest without ebb or flow in the three times. So, this is one of the reasons that in China, where Buddhism came in and Confucianism and Taoism are all ready, very well established. Buddhism was accepted in and appreciated because it provided a methodology which the other two greatly valued. Okay, well, may be able to finish this tomorrow. It's 9:15 already. Any questions as far as we've gone? Yes, Rita.
Thank you. How could you rest without ever flow in the past, present, or future? Couldn't you only do that in the present?
Rest without ebb or flow in the three times. Yeah. So you aren't going into the past, you aren't. Okay. You're not holding the present, yes. I mean, if you turn to page 18. And these are two different translations I made of Talopa's six words. One, I wanted to, in the first one, I wanted to make it very clear what Talopa was saying, because the verbs have those qualities. But if you just translate them literally, it's like, don't think, don't think, don't think. And which doesn't really... but...
But how fun is that?
Yeah. So. But if we take the second six, for instance, which I sought to find English words which all involve the thinking, but give the flavor of what Talopa is pointing to. Don't recall, don't imagine, don't think, don't examine, don't control, rest. Talopa only takes six words, to which Jigme Lingpa takes, you know, but they're both helpful.
Thanks.
Okay. Other questions? Michael.
I just noticed that it shifts into where it is in the first person, and that second chapter is the whole thing in the first person. Like, who is actually saying this? Is it Jigme Lingpa?
It's written by Jigme Lingpa, but one of the ways that a number of Dzogchen texts are written, and another example is The Eyes of the World, it's written in the first person. It's understood this is Samantabhadra speaking. The tone is very similar to some of the Vedas, which are also written. And, you know, I am the Lord, and this is, you see, and Eyes of the World is written in the same way. And there's a prayer... actually, it's the prayer of ever-present good, which I don't have here, but we've done in other retreats, which is also written in the first person. And it's very... When you read it in the first person, then you're letting yourself be Samantabhadra. And there's a certain power which comes from that. And you can even feel it. You can feel it a bit here. I mean... Just try this out. I'll read this out loud, but feel that you're saying this, okay? Because I am free from thinking that distorts experience, the evolution of good and evil actions comes to a complete stop. My nature is universal presence. How can seeing come from progressing through paths and levels? What do you feel there? You get the point? Yeah. So it's not something that we find in any of the other traditions of Tibetan Buddhism that I've come across. But this, there's very definitely a power that comes from it being written in the first person. Okay. Any other comments? Okay. Let's take a few moments to stretch and then meditate.
Retains all rights to these podcasts. If you do wish to use a part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.